I have more announcements than usual, and I know you won't remember them all, but I'm going to make them all anyway. Our next reading is 1 week from tonight in this auditorium. That's February 10th. And the reader is Douglas Canfield, professor in the literature department at the university, and his reading, Various Voices in British and American Poetry. And then our second reading is 2 weeks from tonight, the 17th, and that will be a group of graduate students reading in the terrace lounge of the Student Union. The readers will be Stuart Brown, Nancy Imers, Ann Guido, Terry Pollock, and Cynthia Wilson. There's a special reading this Sunday night at the Mosaic Cafe. The Mosaic is at the corner of Speedway and Silver Bell, west of the campus. That's at 7:30. And the readers are Hal Linke, Julie Godwin, and Jefferson Carter. Pima College is having a very special reading on February 18th. That's 2 weeks from tomorrow. And the reader will be Mae Swenson. Tonight, I hope you can come to the Terrace Lounge. We're going back to the Terrace Lounge tonight for a reception for Mr. Stafford. The Terrace Lounge is the most inaccessible room in the Student Union. So if you'll just kind of follow the leader, you'll find it eventually. What do you say about William Stafford? I don't know. This is my fifth opportunity to hear Mr. Stafford read. Each time, it's a great joy and delight. He's published 5 major collections with Harper and Row, the most recent, Stories That Could Be True, and a large number of small press chapbooks, most recently with Copper Canyon Press, the book Sometimes Like a Legend. He's received all the major awards in American Literature, Guggenheim Grant, National Endowment, National Book Award, and on and on. It's a great pleasure to introduce our friend, William Stafford.
Thank you. Once when the waves were talking, one said, I'll never be back. And then the rest ran on toward shore, but that one went forth so far it's never been seen again. When you walk along sometimes, you think of that absent wave and of all that doesn't exist anymore, things of the other years. They'll never be back, you say. You stop and look out. It's already tomorrow somewhere. Someone like you is walking. A wave is beginning to speak, and the rest shrug and go on. You stand and care. Much has never existed, you know. You think of things to say. Waves come in. Wherever you walk, you see a place for that wave, but it isn't there. I didn't know how to begin, so I've tried this before. I have several beginnings, and that was one way, just once when the waves were talking. Now I have one it's called How It Began. That's why I thought this would be a good way to begin. They struggled their legs and blindly loved those puppies inside my jacket as I walked through town. They crawled for warmth and licked each other, their poor mother dead and one kind boy to save them. I spread my arms over their world and hurried along. At Ellen's place, I knocked and waited, the tumult invading my sleeves, all my jacket alive. When she came to the door, we tumbled, black, white, gray, hungry, all over the living room floor together, rolling, whining, happy, and blind. Now, since I've been here, someone raised a question that's been haunting me for the last 24 hours about whether when you write, things are controlled by images or metaphors or syntax. And I like to make quick moves and then see what happens, so I opted for syntax. But then I was thinking about reading this, carrying the puppies inside my jacket, and I won't belabor this because only a few here were involved in our discussion, but to me it feels like just telling about walking through town carrying puppies in my jacket, you know, that's all. And can I help it if people get other things out of it? No, I can't. Thank you. This is called Serving Gideon. Now I remember, in our town, the druggist prescribed Coca-Cola mostly, in tapered glasses to us, and to the elevator man in a paper cup so he could drink it elsewhere because he was black. And now I remember the Legion, gambling in the back room, and no women but girls, old boys who ran the town. They were generous to their sons or the sons of friends. And of course, I was almost one. I remember winter light closing its great blue fist slowly eastward along the street. And the dark, then, deep as war, arched over a radio show called The 30s in the great old USA. Look down, stars. I was almost one of the boys. My mother was folding her handkerchief. The library seethed and sparked. Right and wrong arced. And carefully, I walked with my cup toward the elevator man. Now, when I was reading this, I got several little signals from myself, and those happen. I try to disregard them so as to keep up the momentum in a poem, but I was almost derailed by the realization here that a distinction that I have is being so old. That's what almost derailed me. That is that I could refer to the 30s, you know, a radio show called The 30s in the great old USA, and I thought of saying to you, children, there was a time when they didn't have television. It was a radio show. And the strange vision that comes to me is standing in the University of Kansas, facing a radio, just the way we'd face a television set, and listening to President Roosevelt. Well, I have... I had to stop a minute and think I better not get hysterical. Well, I mean, historical. I have here a poem that I've often identified as my weakest poem. And as my friends and semi-friends know, I have a lot of candidates for this honor of the weakest. But this is the one that that starts with very little and ends with nothing. So, in that sense, weakest. And this is my theory of writing, as my semi-friends know. I start with anything, and then just see what happens. It's called The Little Girl by the Fence at School. Grass that was moving found all shades of brown. Moved them along, flowed autumn away, galloping southward where summer had gone. And that was the morning someone's heart stopped and all became still. A girl said, "Forever?" And the grass, "Yes, forever." While the sky. When I was trying to figure out what to bring and what to sequence, I wanted to have variety if I could. I realize some of my limitations. And so I guess I'm begging your indulgence if I seem to be scrambling in various directions here, because I have something that, and I'm not sure how relevant this is to your setting, though when I look at a map of the country with little dots around it, I believe maybe it's relevant everywhere. It's called incident. They had this cloud they kept like a zeppelin tethered to a smokestack, and you couldn't see it, but it sent out these strange little rays, and after a while you felt funny. They had this man with a box. He pointed it at the zeppelin, and it said, "Jesus." The man hurried farther away and called out, "Hear ye, hear ye." Then they coaxed the zeppelin down into the smokestack, and they said, "We won't do that anymore." For a long time, the box kept shaking its head, but it finally said, "Okay, it." But quietly to us, it whispered, "Let's get out of here." One of the things I was thinking of sort of breaking the sequence up with was confessions about all sorts of things, but one is just where things are published. And I see Field Magazine, Oberlin, Hampton Sydney Poetry Review, American Poetry Review. I don't know, the one's from a book, but it must have been somewhere else too. This one, Incident, the reason I thought of this at this moment is, I thought, after I wrote Incident, I thought, where shall I send this? So I sent it to a magazine in Pennsylvania called the Slow Loris Reader. And I like to identify these heroic magazines that are all over the country putting out poetry. This is called Yellow Cars. Some of the cars are yellow that go by. Those you look at, so glimmering when light glances at their passing. Think of that hope. Someone will like me, maybe. The tan ones don't care. The blue have made a mistake. The white haven't tried. But the yellow, you turn your head. Hope lasts a long time if you're happy. I just want to stop long enough on this to, and maybe I hope I won't trouble this issue very much this evening, but just stop on it for a minute. How easy writing is, how all of us practice every day the language. We don't resolutions that we're going to get up the energy to compose something today. We get up and say, "What's for breakfast?" or, you know, whatever. We start talking the great novel of our lives without even knowing we're doing it. How easy it is. Some of the cars are yellow that go by. Those you look at, and so on. And it's as if, well, as I said, I guess I won't belabor this. But to me, it's as if you get positioned right for the experience as it comes to you, you can even make all kinds of mistakes. But if you don't get situated right, then finesse won't save it. I mean, there's just a kind of way to blunder along, or sometimes it seems so to me. Maybe it's all too evident to you. This is called anticipating. Keeping your word is bell into a future memory to wait there. You hold that stilled bell hidden, but you know where the sound will be, deep and slow, ready to toll all day, all night, miles around. Others may change their word. They can pile rocks on it. They back away. They dance on the stones, but the bell waits in its crypt, and it slowly moves. I neglected to say places where poems are published. This is published in a magazine called Three Sisters. I believe it's Georgetown University in D.C. If you're writing where you are about things that occur to you, and the writings just grow out of how it happens, and you're not aiming for certain magazines or certain markets or certain fashions, then what happens? What happens to you? Maybe nothing, but maybe there are, over the country, there are these magazines that are not looking where fashions are, and they're not looking to strengthen the national will or anything like that, or attack it either. They're just interested in things that happen, that occur to people over the country. So that's why I think of mentioning some of these. I'll mention the place of publication first on this one, because probably this is the best, this is the best phrase on the page. It's the name of the magazine where it was published. Negative Capability is the name of it. A new magazine. Though not a new phrase. It's called Dropout. Grundy and Hoagland and all the rest who ganged our class and wrecked the high school gym for fun. You thought of them last night and how they laughed when they beat up a Mexican. Later they marched against Hitler Youth, but admired them too, how they were brave and sang. Why, you should see how those troopers fought. And Hoagland came back to a job with the FBI. Remember the team, the celebration in the Lions Hall, with Coach Gist there, a real man, the speeches, the jackrabbit chili. You looked through the smoke and the smoky jokes and vomited and never went back again. Best in a class yesterday afternoon that this all started for me, just from the names of some people I began to think of in my high school class, and the names were the best thing that occurred to me, and they were from memory, but I had to change the names because, but I did my best. When I came back to Earth, it was my bike through me. I woke today, not real day. Some of the sunlight came like bottles piled in a window frame. People were pictures with labels, doctor, intern, aide. I remember a cookie big as the sun that lasted as long as a glass of milk. Someday, your world won't last all day. You'll blink, you'll fall to earth, and where the ocean was will be that color here was before you came. Your head and what you hit will sound the same. Partly just to put some insulation between these poems, I want to say that I had this brilliant idea of giving my dog a workout, and when I'd take it out on the leash, I'd get the workout. So I decided I'd get on my bicycle and really make that dog work. And it was fine, except there was another dog. And as you bicycle riders can imagine, all sorts of odd things began to happen. And that's when I found out it's a good idea to have a helmet on. It was just right, you know, not too hard, but enough that I knew it was real. Once in the 40s, we were alone one night on a long road in Montana. This was in winter, a big night far to the stars. We had hitched, my wife and I, and left our ride at a crossing to go on. Tired and cold, but brave, we trudged along. This, we said, was our life, watched over, allowed to go where we wanted. We said we'd come back sometime when we got rich. We'd leave the others and find a night like this, whatever we had to give, no matter how far, to be so happy again. I just want to stop for a minute for insulation among these poems. Say, when you think about it, how rich we are. You know, we can do the things we want to. And I can remember going out hiking in the winter, and it's just fun to get far from any place. It's cold, and just to be able to make it, you know, have a good enough jacket, hike along. And one place where I was, I read this poem once in the 40s, and there was a girl in the audience that was up in Bemidji in Minnesota, come to think of it. And when they say winter, they mean winter up there. And she came up after the reading. She said, "I hitchhiked 60 miles to get here tonight, and I want to take a look at your poem, Once in the 40s. We felt this kinship, you know, we young people. Last summer, I was at a couple of writers' conferences. One was on the East Coast and one on the West. And at Port Townsend, we'd go into a kind of big barracks for our lunch, and you'd get your plate and knife and fork and spoon, napkin, all a certain way. And this comes from that. It's called Objector. In line at lunch, I cross my fork and spoon to ward off complicity, the ordered life our leaders have offered us. Thin as a knife, our chance to live depends on such a sign while others talk. The Pentagon from the moon is bouncing exact commands. Forget your faith, be ready for whatever it takes to win. We face annihilation unless all citizens get in line. I bow and cross my fork and spoon. Somewhere other citizens more fearfully bow in a place terrorized by their kind of oppressive state. Lines both mean, you hostages over there will never be slaughtered by my act. Our vows cross, never to kill and call it fate. Well, I have here, I hurry on to something called School Days. It has three parts, but they're not very long. After the test, they sent an expert questioner to our school. Who is this kid Bohr? When Bohr came in, he asked the expert, "Who are you?" And for a long time, they looked at each other, and Bohr said, "Thanks, I thought so." Then they talked about why the test was given. Afterwards, they shook hands and Bohr walked slowly away. He turned and called out, "You passed." Part two of School Days. Enough sleet had pasted over the window by 3 o'clock, so we couldn't tell if it was dark, and our pony would be out there in the little shed waiting to take us home. Teacher banked the stove with an extra log. That was the storm of 1934. For 2 days we waited, singing and praying, and I guess it worked, even though the snow drifted over the roof. But the pony was dead when they dug us out. Part three of School Days. At a tiny desk, inside my desk, a doll bends over a book. In the book is a feather found at the beach from a dead gull. While Miss Leonard reads The Highwayman, I bend over my book and cry and fly all alone through the night toward being this person I am. Now, when I was reading this, I don't want you to think about this too seriously, but I suddenly had this little ripple of apprehension. What am I doing? You know, what sort of thing am I reading? What are these things? School Days. who is this kid Bohr, and so on. Well, I want to face up to this for just a minute. Oh, well, I don't quite know how to do it. They're not, I mean, after all, it's not charge of the light gate or anything like that. It's just little bits of language, just little excursions. And I remember, and I've even put this in an article, and I know some people here know it, but I was reading a biography of Niels Bohr, the scientist from Denmark. And they told about how when he was in school, when he was a kid in school, they tried to teach him composition. Well, you know, Niels Bohr was a lucky kid. He must have been the torrent experience going through his head. But he couldn't get this pattern they had for composition. They taught him that anything he wrote had to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And Aristotle knew it, and everybody since, maybe earlier, I don't know. But Niels Bohr, you know, wheels in his head. So I memorized the last sentence in one of his themes he wrote when he was in school. It was this: "And I would also like to mention aluminum." That's why I thought of, say, you know, some questioner says, "Who is this kid Bohr?" There was a request, and I want to read a poem that was requested. I'm glad to put it in. It's called "My Father," October 1942. He picks up what he thinks is a road map, and it is his death. He holds it easily, and nothing can take it from his firm hand. The pulse in his thumb on the map says, 1:19 p.m. next Tuesday at this intersection. And an ambulance begins to throb while his face looks tired. Anytime anyone may pick up something so right that he can't put it down. That is the problem for all who travel. They fatally own whatever is really theirs. And that is the inner thread, the lock, what can hold. If it is to be, nothing breaks it. Millions of observers guess all the time, but each person, once, can say, sure. Then he's an observer. He isn't right or wrong. He just wins or loses. I shuffled some of these things out of the sequence I had them, thinking I may leave them out entirely, but I want to go back to one that wasn't. It's a matter of feeling too much and one sort of thing happening. But I hope this is all right with a little dilution of things in between. It's called "A Walk in the Country." To walk anywhere in the world, to live now, to speak, to breathe a harmless breath. What snowflake even may try today so calm a life, so mild a death? Out in the country once, walking the hollow night, I felt a burden of silver come. My back had come light pouring through the trees like money. That walk was late, though. Late I gently came into town, and a terrible thing had happened. The world, wide, unbearably bright, had leaped on me. I carried mountains. Though there was much I knew, though kind people turned away, I walked there ashamed into that still picture to bring my fear and pain. By dawn I felt all right. My hair was covered with dew. The light was bearable. The air came still and cool. And God had come back there to carry the world again. Since then, while over the world the wind appeals events and people contend like fools, like a stubborn tumbleweed I hold where I live and look into every face. Oh, friends, Where can one find a partner for the long dance over the fields? I want to hasten on to something called With Neighbors One Afternoon. I can just feel myself relaxing when I say this. Neighbors One Afternoon. I have to stop for a minute. As I started to read this line, I realized I was stumbling into something. This is a fairly recent poem, one before that snags my attention. Was farther back, when we had to say someone he or everyone he. We couldn't say someone they. Okay, the revolution has happened. So, are there any teachers of composition here? That's all right. I'm in your generation too. I'm going to go in the next generation for a minute. With Neighbors One Afternoon. Someone said, stirring their tea, I would come home any time just for this, to look out the clear backyard air and then into the cup. You could see the tiniest pattern of bark on the trees and every slight angle of color change in the sunshine. Millions of miles of gold light lavished on people like us. You could put out your hand and feel the rush of the years rounding your life into these days of ours. From somewhere a leaf came gliding slowly down and rested on the lawn. Remember that scene? Inside it, you folded the last of your jealousy and hate and all those deeds so hard to forget. Absolution. Swish. You took the past into your mouth and swallowed it. Warm, thin, bitter. Thank you. I was at a class in the afternoon at a college in Oregon about 3 weeks ago. And one of the students had a question. We read each other's work and talked back and forth. And one of the students said, a teacher told me never to have three adjectives in a row. What do you think of that? Well, if you travel around, you meet these emergencies all the time. You know, you want to stay in good with everybody. And then maybe the faculty is taking you out to dinner, and here's this student loosing this quail all of a sudden. You say, what shall I do? So I did all sorts of things. Anyway, I began to brood about it. And in the reading that night, I found myself reading this poem, and I felt myself coming toward the end, and I knew something awful was going to happen. Warm, thin, bitter, and good. So the next week, by the way, after the class, this teacher said, the person who told me was, she told me the name. I said, I know that teacher. And he stopped by with a manuscript of his poems. And I said, I heard... Well, I'll tell you who it was, Primus St. John. I said, Primus, I heard you told a student you can't use three adjectives in a row. Well, that sounds pretty good. I've always believed in not too many adjectives and so on. And he sort of looked at me and said, I guess I told her not to use three adjectives. This is called Judgments. I accuse Ellen. You have become 40 years old and successful, tall, well-groomed, great, thoughtful, a secretary. Ellen, I accuse. George, you know how to help others. You manage a school. You never let fear or pride or faltering plans break your control. George, I accuse. I accuse Tom. You have found a role. Now you meet all kinds of people and let them find the truth of your eminence. You need not push. Oh, Tom, I do accuse. Remember the gawky, hardly to survive students we were? Not one of us going to succeed, all of us abjectly aware of how cold, unmanageable the real world was? I remember, and that fear was true, and is true. Last, I accuse myself, my terrible poise, knowing this, knowing that then we sprawled in the world and were ourselves part of it. Now we hold it firmly away with gracious gestures like this of mine. We've achieved. I see it all too well, and I am accused, and I accuse. I shift my feet because I wanted to make a kind of a transition. And I realized I just pounded along these poems for quite a while. I once went to a poetry reading given by Mark Van Doren. Again, I'm bringing history. And he was a charming, really a winsome person. And I was interested in his poetry. And I think he talked for about an hour and a half. I'm not going to do that. About an hour. 50 minutes to an hour. He talked about an hour and a half, and it was all wonderful. But he read only three short poems. And I thought, that's really getting mileage out of poems. That's the way to do it. I just have to go pounding along. I'll get a little mileage out of this. There was a teacher at Portland State in Oregon who fell asleep while lecturing. So I told Mark Van Doren about that, and he so easily topped me. He said at the University of Chicago, John Dewey fell asleep while lecturing on attention. Well, back to pounding away. It's called At the Klamath of Berry Festival. The war chief danced the old way, the eagle wing he held before his mouth. And when he turned, the boom, boom stopped. He took two steps. A sociologist was there. The scout troop danced. I envied him the places he had not been. The boom began again. Outside, he heard the stick game and the Blackfoot gamblers arguing at poker under lanterns. Still moccasined and bashful, holding an eagle wing before his mouth, listening and listening, he danced after others stopped. He took two steps. The boom caught up. The mountains rose. The still deep river slid but never broke the quiet. I looked back when I left. He took two steps. He took two steps. Sociologist. When I looked at this old one, and down at the bottom where it was published in a magazine, I want to use my age here to say, it was published in a magazine at Chico in California by someone no one had heard of, named John Gardner at Chico State. About 2 years ago, I heard from the other side of the country, Binghamton, New York, where John Gardner is now. Out at Chico State, his magazine was called Mount Shasta Selections. Someone was looking for poems for a magazine called MSS. I don't know whether you say manuscripts or MSS. And so I wrote, because I knew where Gardner was, and I said, is this the same old magazine that was Mount Shasta Selection on MSS? And so it's like two lives, you know, the long gap in between. So creeping into Mount Shasta Selection, creeping into MSS. I still don't, well, I'd call it Mount Shasta Selections, but I suppose it's changed. Since I read an old one called At the Klamath Berry Festival, I'll read another called The Farm on the Great Plain. A telephone line goes cold. Birds tread it wherever it goes. A farm back of a great plain tugs an end of the line. I call that farm every year, ringing it, listening, still. No one is home at the farm. The line gives only a hum. Some year I will ring the line on a night at last, the right one, and with an eye tapered for break from the phone on the wall, I will see the tenant who waits, the last one left at the place. Through the dark, my braille eye will lovingly touch his face. Hello, is mother at home? No one is home today. But father, he should be here. No one. No one's here. But you, are you the one? Then the line will be gone because both ends will be home. No space, no birds, no farm. Myself will be the plain, wise as winter is gray, pure as cold posts go, pacing toward what I know. When I was reading this, I thought again, and since the student generations are so brief, even it here once, I'm going to say it again. My contribution to the academic altitude of this occasion is to give a truth about language. Some syllables are more equal than others. Is this great truth? What if it really is a truth, and that without your knowing it, without the dictionary even thinking of telling you about it, when you look up definitions, these syllables make a difference? So that if, I thought of it in connection with this, because that the world champion syllable is all around through this poem, not because I thought of putting it there, but just because if you get on a certain wavelength with yourself, God and everybody else begins to help you put things together, sort of the feeling. And in this poem, that world champion syllable is in farm, in home, in hum, and of other of the words. And, it, of course, it is that syllable, om, om, om. And it has so much power that people all over the world meditate with it. It comes from right in the center of you. What if every time you say a word with that syllable in it, it's either helping or hurting? And what if you begin to use the language so that those subliminal helpings and hurtings line up like iron filings for you? Then you may be doing something in language, and even you won't know what it is, and the critics may say, What's the idea? And you say, I don't know. I just sort of like it. And then later, someone finds out what it was. Well, I want to read the... this is for friends in writing workshop and so on. I want to read the ideal form for a poem I just recently discovered. I mean, for me, it's the ideal form. It's one in which you can just keep accumulating things and have more or less, and you put them in any order you like. You can leave out some if you like, or add some more, and you'll see how it is. Just called Things I Learned Last Week. Ants, when they meet each other, usually pass on the right. A man in New York has dedicated himself to telling about injustice. For $3,000, he will come to your town and tell you about it. Sometimes you can open a sticky door with your elbow. Schopenhauer was a pessimist, but he blew. Yeats, Pound, and Eliot saw art as growing from other art. They studied that. If I ever die, I'd like it to be in the evening. That way I'll have all the dark to go with me, and no one will see how I begin to hobble away. In the Pentagon, one person's job is to take pins out of towns, hills, and fields, and then save the pins for later. Well, you can see how it would go on. It could go on. Turn your head a certain way. Thank you. Thank you. I was in the Washington, D.C. area a year ago this last fall. I was staying with someone who lived out in the outskirts and had a nice backyard, and it was in the early fall, good weather. Didn't have to go to work till later in the day. We were going to various schools around there, and we'd sit out and we'd read the Washington Post and have our breakfast. And one time I was sitting out there in the sunshine on this beautiful day reading the Washington Post when I came to a headline that I'll never forget. And this is it. It was on one of the back pages. It said, 12-minute warning of A attack needed to evacuate officials. So while I was, for some reason, staring at that headline and thinking about sitting at the edge of Washington, D.C., I heard a helicopter coming like mad out of the center of Washington, D.C. And I read the headline again, 12-minute warning of A attack needed to evacuate officials. And I thought of a kind of a little haiku. It's like this. These people are nice, but their priorities are different from ours. So then I wrote a little bit longer. That got me going. Something called Maybe. I don't know if it's been published. It's called Maybe. Maybe it's a fear. Maybe someone decides. Maybe it takes only one. Maybe the end begins. Maybe it has begun. It runs through the drills fast and they all respond well and it's over. Then an explorer comes. What could they have done? They could have tried harder. They could have become meaner. But maybe nothing. It happened. The explorer turns over a stone. Maybe those who sang were the lucky ones. Well, I hurry on to something else. Another old guitar. For years, I was tuned a few notes too high. I don't see how I could stand it. You can imagine the strain, hours of teen parties, then beach trips with Michael Rode the Boat, and later the marches in all weather singing, We Shall Overcome. Then I moved on. Now I play in an Eskimo band in Alaska. I'll never get back outside through storms. I dream of returning under a river, breathing through a straw, carried where the current hides itself by being just the river. No. We play in the tin buildings for the Air Force and end with a relaxed little number that the band call their national anthem. Someday, maybe. Well, in class, sometimes we talk about taking other points of view, you know, adopting a persona. And so you can be another old guitar, you can be anything, and the world turns into a various kind of place just by just a slight displacing of yourself. And on some of those earlier ones I was reading, like The Farm on the Great Plain, where it says, with an eye tapered for Braille and so on, I stop and I try to visualize this and I realize I'm in trouble. But what I wanted to say is that sometimes it seems to me that writing is, or maybe any of the arts, sort of like pure math. You cut loose from the real world and you make this great big loop. And sometimes you come out back into the real world with tremendous velocity that you wouldn't have had. So I would like to just feel free about those things, whether I ever get up the velocity or not. I want to read about four more poems, and I'll be on that 50-minute hour that we talked about, and then sociability for those who like it. And I wouldn't like always to be on the same kind of poem, so excuse me if I shuffle a little bit here, because I've got thousands of poems. This one, I want to read slowly. Sometime, when the river's ice, ask me mistakes I've made. Ask me whether what I've done is my life. Others have come in their slow way into my thought, and some have tried to help or to hurt. Ask me what their strongest love or hate has made. I will listen to what you say. You and I can turn and look at the silent river and wait. We know the current is there, hidden, and there are comings and goings from miles away that hold the stillness exactly before us. What the river says, that is what I say. I want to hurry to one I remembered that I had here. In fact, I think I've got the sequence. I was at the University of Michigan, and the fellow there named Stephen Dunning has a lot of ideas to get people to write. He had invited a poet named Grace Butcher, motorcycle driver and poet. So she had a lot going for her with those students. And she gave us an assignment. She said, think of something that happened, but don't tell what happened, tell what you wish it happened. Or think of something you said, but don't tell what you said, tell what you wish you'd said. And she gave us a half an hour, and we all began to write. It was a workshop in which you wrote. So we went on. It's in another state. Well, anyway, she added one thing that I want to put in here. She said, try to use more of the senses than you usually would think of using. So I wrote, one time when evening had flowed between houses and paused on the school ground, I met Hillary's blind little sister following the gray, smooth railing still warm from the sun with her hand. And she stood by the edge holding her face upward, waiting while the last light found her cheek and her hair and then on over the trees. You could hear the great sprinkler arm of water find and then leave the pavement, and pigeons telling each other their dreams or the dreams they would have. We were deep in the well of shadow by then, and I held out my hand, saying, Tina, it's me. Hillary says I should tell you it's dark, and oh, Tina, it is. Together now. And I reached, our hands touched, and we found our way home. Well, you can see how if someone asks you, you know, use more senses, it's a strange thing that happens, almost like that pure math again, you know, you haul back, you give up some senses in order to have others, and so all sorts of things begin to happen. I guess I'm looking around appealing for, you know, all you writers, all you artists. Isn't it strange? Isn't it strange? All right, now, since I had a number of fairly dismal poems, I want to read, I want to put in this next to the last, an old one, called Religion Back Home. When God's parachute failed, along about the spring of 1945, the sky in Texas jerked open, and we all sailed easily into this new strange harness on the stars. This has four parts. Part two of Religion Back Home. The minister smoked and he drank And there was that woman in the choir. But what really him? He wore spats. Part three of religion back home is a short review of Samson Agonistes, written for Miss Arrington's class in Liberal High School. Our Father who art in heaven can lick their Father who art in heaven. Well, this is the last. This is the last of religion back home. When my little brother chanted in 1492, Jesus crossed the ocean blue, Mother said, Bob, you mean Columbus crossed the ocean blue? And he said, I always did get them two guys mixed up. Well, I want to read one last poem, or whatever they are. And thank you for this welcome as I bundle these things together and get ready for the sociability. But I'll read one that just happens to be here, and I'd be all right. It's called A Gesture Toward an Unfound Renaissance. There was the slow girl in art class, less able to say where our lessons led. We learned so fast she could not follow us. But at the door each day I looked back at her rich distress, knowing almost enough to find a better art inside the lesson. And then, late at night, when the whole town was alone, the current below the rumbly bridge at Main Street would go an extra swirl and gurgle once by the pilings. And at my desk at home, or when our house opened above my bed toward the stars, I would hear that one intended, lonely sound, the signature of the day, the ratchet of time, taking me toward here, now, and this look back through that door that always closes.